You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Joseph Skillen.
This is Chris Golic.
I'm Joe Salcihi, and you're listening to the Earn and Invest Podcast.
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Current Events Thursday. This is a new type of episode here on Earn and Invest on the last Thursday of every month where we discuss breaking or maybe even broken financial news with both an expert as well as community members. Community members have volunteered to add the perspective of the common man or woman behind the podcast player, but of course we know that Earn and Invest listeners are anything but common. Today, we are joined by expert Joe Salcihi, who is the creator and co-host of the Stacking Benjamins podcast, also known as the greatest money show on earth. He's the author of Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. From our community, we have Christina Golic and Joseph Skillen. Joe, Christina, and Joseph, welcome to Earn and Invest. Let's get right to the article. This is from Business Insider, and it's titled The Upside of Recessions by Aki Ito.
Aki writes, "There's a reason governments spend so many taxpayer dollars at digging their economies out of recessions. Families lose their homes, children go malnourished, new grads spend years struggling to get their careers back on track for going marriage and kids and homeownership. But a growing body of research suggests that recessions are good for at least one thing, longevity. Puzzlingly, it appears that economic downturns actually extend people's lives. The latest evidence comes from Lives vs. Livelihoods, a new paper by four researchers led by the renowned health economist Amy Finkelstein. They found that during the Great Recession from 2007 to 2009, age-adjusted mortality rates among Americans dropped 0.5% for every jump of 1 percentage point in an area's unemployment rate. The more joblessness, the longer people lived, especially adults over 64 and those without a college education. These mortality reductions appear immediately, the economist concluded, and they persist for at least 10 years. The effects were so large that the recession effectively provided 4% of all 55-year-olds with an extra year of life." We're going to get to this article and much, much more, but first, let's introduce our community members. Christina, you are up first. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I am currently living in Indonesia. I'm on a little island called Gili Air, enjoying the retirement life. I'm getting ready to celebrate my one-year anniversary of early retirement. So I've been in the FI communities since about 2018, 2019, and I'm really excited to have this conversation today.
We are so excited to have you here. And Joseph, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you, Doc G. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show. I'm currently living in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I'm a musician and an academic. I work in the higher ed space, and I've retired from one higher ed job in Louisiana to take a second type of position in North Carolina. And I've, as a musician, financial independence has always been on front of mind for me because of the type of variable income that a musician can expect through their lifetime.
Well, we would think having lots of income and being busy with work and a job is good for us, but maybe according to this article, it isn't. Joe, let's dive right in. Does this article pass the sniff test? Could recessions really be good for us?
Yeah, I was thinking the opposite. I was thinking recessions could be really bad for us, right? And seeing that it's good, you know what? That wasn't as surprising as the findings of this study, because as I began to read, and I don't know about the rest of you, I started postulating, why could that be? And my personal thought was, and we'll get to what the researchers found, but my personal thought was, you know, there's this whole idea of purpose. And of course, you're working on this huge purpose project right now, and that people are more successful with retirement if they have a sense of purpose, if they have a feeling about purpose. In fact, we were talking about my spouse, Cheryl, her uncle has lived much longer than anybody else in that family. But you can see his sense of purpose. You can feel his sense of purpose. And Wes Moss's book about what the happiest retirees know that I feel like I reference all the time now, all the studies in there talk about purpose. So my thought was that during the time of a recession, you don't find purpose. Purpose finds you. And you have to be a little bit better. You've got to find a way to get the family fed. You know, even if not at a cerebral level, at more of an animal level, you know things are tough. And so you got to be on your toes. So that was my thought process as I dove into that. Turns out, I don't know if I was wrong, but that wasn't at all where this piece was headed.
Christina, Joe's take is interesting, right? Because he's talking about this idea that maybe when you're not otherwise busy with work, purpose could find you. But I'd also think a lot of people make work their sense of purpose, which again would then lead us to believe that getting away from that sense of purpose when you're being laid off during a recession would actually cause you to have a greater morbidity mortality, be less happy. Christina, tell us your thoughts. Do you think purpose plays a role in this? I know as we went further in the article, they give reasons why they believe this happens, but how does purpose play a role?
Yeah, I was definitely thrown off by this article too, because I do know plenty of people that have been laid off and lost jobs for various reasons. And they have not found their purpose, like Joe was saying. They fell into depression. They didn't know what to do. They were having a very hard time trying to find a similar position, maybe just with a different company. Some were trying to get outside of the box a little bit and try something new. And I know myself, I'm a little different. Everyone has always called me the overachiever. And I have a few friends that kind of have that entrepreneurial spirit. But for the most part, everyone does the typical kind of 9-to-5 career in some field. So I was really thrown off by this article, but I also thought that it was quite interesting too, once they actually got down to the nitty gritty with the results.
Joseph, I mean, we've heard this said multiple times, no pain, no gain. What doesn't kill us makes us stronger. I mean, could that be playing a role here with a tough recession? Like maybe that kind of trauma builds a strength in us that we didn't know would be there?
Possibly. I think about my experience as a musician and a creative artist that we're sort of used to economies flexing and maybe going the opposite direction of the normal economy would be. And many of my colleagues, my peers that work in those spaces kind of are doing it out of a sense of purpose in the first place. And so we find almost the exact opposite, that when the economy shifts to a point of stress and strain that a recession provides, that's precisely when people are looking for the type of work that we do. The escapism, perhaps, that one might find in entertainment or seeking a greater sense of purpose, they find people who they perceive to have already found their purpose because they're working already for a sense of purpose and not for the hustle culture or the 9-to-5 kind of culture that we often see in what I would call more normal 9-to-5 types of careers, like Christina mentioned.
But and it's funny, Joseph, because I remember seeing after the 2000 to 2002 downturn in the market and that recession, the number of people that left big tech firms as the tech bubble was blowing up and founded these new, really creative companies. And that's really where, quote, Web 2.0 came from, right? Where these people, it wasn't a 22-year-old going out making a new company. It was actually mostly people over 50 that were making these very successful companies at that time. So even when it comes to 9-to-5, I think that a recession can provide purpose. But it's interesting because I like Chris's point too, that, and that's all about mindset, isn't it? It's whether you give up or not. Like I've seen people then too, they go, you know what? Instead of seeing this as a recession, they take it personally. Mm. And they say, you know what? This is an indictment of me about my contribution to society, and I just don't have a place anymore. So I think that's going to determine whether a recession to me provides greater purpose or throws you off your game?
You know, it's really interesting. And Joseph's point really hits home for me because, I mean, we glamorize the starving artist, right? So when you're talking about kind of more the artistic stuff, this idea that hurting actually, you create deeper, more important work. And so I would say many artists would tell you that they didn't really earn their chops unless they went through that starving period where things were really difficult. Let me pivot or flip the script a little bit. Christina, if we just take this as the truth, the article asks an interesting question. Would you prefer wealth that kills you or poverty that keeps you alive?
Yeah, it is. It is a very good question. Yeah, I need a minute to think about that one.
Good. I finally stumped someone. I've been trying to get harder and harder questions to try to stump someone. So, Christina, thank you very much. I finally
You're
earned
welcome.
My keep. Joseph, chime in.
Your question reminds me of one of the early books that I read beginning a career as a creative, and that was the Vicki Robbins' Your Money or Your Life. That was just sort of a way that I began to think about processing what a life in a creative economy might be, even such that I wanted to get married. I wanted to have a family. We did that, but I could just promise adventure. And just thinking about what that was and thinking about sort of FI before FI was cool, in that you reduce your expenses to the point that anything you earn is what you survive on, and you find a way to make that happen. I built a career from a creative space by learning to hustle. And when I wanted to have more income, I approached it that way rather than thinking about reducing. It was more a question of increasing as I went along, but sort of setting that stable floor and thinking about life really truly is more important than the money that you're earning. It was a place of necessity initially, but it really helped us kind of establish a quality of family life, really. And then it was just a question of earning the more money if we just chose to do and have nicer things, essentially.
I think this question, Doc, cuts to the really a basic question, which is, does more money equal more happiness? And happy is happy and wealth is wealth. And certainly, don't get me wrong, going to your, you know, as I've heard other people say, showing up at your problems in a limousine is way more fun than walking to them. More wealth doesn't equal more happy. They're two different things. Almost like money nerds often equate cheaper with better. Cheaper is cheaper and it can be better, but cheaper is not always better. Cheapening things is, they're not the same thing. So I think when we ask wealth and less versus poverty and more, you can be very, very happy having less. And I think part of having that frugal mindset, a little bit of stoicism, you know, where we're just happy being here and everything that comes to us, we're grateful for, is a great way to live.
Chris, I saw you shaking your head kind of yes, as Joe was saying that about maybe that we can also be happy with less. Tell me what you were thinking.
That I was absolutely a victim of lifestyle inflation. And I, you know, I grew my careers, I changed jobs so I could climb that infamous corporate ladder so I could earn more income. I've always had 2 to 3 side jobs on top of my primary career. So I wasn't going to be, you know, hand to mouth. And then I learned about the FI communities and I sold everything. Now all I have, I don't have the big 4-bedroom house, 2,500 square foot home. I have a medium-sized suitcase and a day pack, and everything I own is 25 kilos. But I had the cars, the motorcycles, the house, the clothes, the watches, the purses. I had it all. I wanted it all. And I did enjoy it. There was a lot that I did get out of it, but I know, and I feel like I had an addiction to consumerism because I would get a good internal high after buying a new purse or buying a new Movado watch, getting my second motorcycle when I didn't need it. And now that I don't have any of that, and I have 10 shirts and 2 pairs of shoes and a beautiful new suitcase, though, I'm really, really happy. And I'm living on a tiny island in the middle of nowhere right now. So so I've had it all, though. I've experienced both ends. And I really love where I am now, the life I've built now.
I'm reminded, Chris's comment reminded me of a situation from the opposite end of the spectrum when I was in Galway, Ireland, leading a study abroad in a higher ed setting. And I met some retirees that kind of were achieving their goal of, we're able to stay in Galway for 2 weeks. And they were asking me, how'd you get here, essentially? And I just said, well, I'm paid to be here for 6 weeks showing these students the country of Ireland. And I did this for 14 summers in a row. And they just kind of looked at me like, you're breaking all the rules. You're supposed to retire and have all this stuff. And then I found a way to pursue my passion of travel and just have other people pay for that and my job pay for that. And the disconnect of them just kind of looking at me and sort of saying, it's just kind of not fair that you're able to do something for 6 weeks that we can only afford to do for 2 weeks that we saved our entire life to do, but you're doing now as your job. How did this happen? For me, I think some of it started with the idea of, you know, that your money or your life and just what your passions are, you'll make those things happen, but just maybe not do those other things, the consumerism that Chris mentioned.
Joe, there's this phenomenon called the Easterlin paradox. And let me see if I don't mess this up. But what they found is that if they took economically underserved communities and brought in money to those communities and distributed it evenly among everyone, there was a short-term improvement of happiness, but it didn't last very long. And so part of the thought process was that it was actually comparative changes in wealth that helped people, or at least make people happy. Like, you're happy when you have more than your neighbor, but if both you and your neighbor have more, all of a sudden it doesn't really move the needle much. It reminds me of kind of what this article is saying. Are there downsides to economy growth as a whole? We're talking about longevity here, but is it serving people the way they think it's going to serve them?
Man, I don't know. You know, that one may be above my pay grade. Because that is a big life question. I mean, this idea of relative happiness just makes me groan about just how animal we are. You know, I don't care if I'm better off. I just want to be better than you. Like, that is horrible. That's rotten. But I think of this whole feeling that, you know, no matter where you go, there you are. And happiness starts from the inside. And I can be unhappy with less money. I can be unhappy with more money. And I got to show up. So I do think that while economic conditions improve for everybody, that has the ability to make me happier, but I have to choose. And too often, I think many of us choose the animal instinct of, well, I'm not better off than the person next to me, so I'm going to choose unhappiness.
I think of the experiments with universal basic income that allow different populations that, you know, where they've been running this, that feel more confident in taking risks or taking challenges when they know there's going to be a floor that is going to protect them. And it kind of removes some of this competition aspect, and it just allows a person to think more about striving rather than surviving. And I think that's an interesting way to maybe potentially consider this, that even if you own your own universal basic income, you know, as across a society, I think it's a wonderful thing to think about. But even if you just think of your own basic income and then strive from there, that might be in that striving where that happiness lies.
Christina, in a moment, we're going to talk about what the article mentions is the cause of this increased longevity. But before we go there, I feel like I want to talk more about this concept of having a good economy feels like an improvement. It feels like something we're working for. And there are these other things in society that often feel like improvements. And I wonder if there are some negative impacts with them too. So we talk about technology has led to things like nuclear weapons. And certainly, you know, nuclear weapons could really inhibit a lot of our longevity if that goes wrong. Technology is also
could ruin
huge.
Your day.
Yeah, it's like really could ruin many of our days. But but what about things like social media? Like, we think of social media and technology and the internet as this huge improvement. Anyone who was trying to get anything done in the 1980s knows how different it is today and how much easier it is. But we also see a lot of the negative impacts, right? We know that kids, for instance, have more depression and anxiety. People are spending more time in their phones as opposed to building authentic communities together, et cetera. So it kind of gets back to this idea that, you know, are there multiple things in society now that we think are improvements or good, like a good economy or social media or the, you know, the internet or even the building of weapons to protect ourselves, but are we maybe getting some of this wrong? Like, is technology bad?
That's a double-edged sword, right? And I was just having a conversation about that exact question the other day with a new friend that I've made where I'm living right now. You know, here I am on a tiny, tiny island. There's no motor vehicles whatsoever. You walk on small paths, you ride a bicycle, or there's a horse and carriage, like old school horse and carriage. And that's how the workers here, there's a lot of construction going on. They load up the carriage with all the supplies and they move them. So it's very historic, old school ways, which I absolutely love seeing and experiencing. However, I'm very grateful that I'm living in a place with electricity, Wi-Fi, air conditioning, flush toilet, hot water in the shower. It's very important too, because not all places have hot water. And yeah, so I definitely like my modern day amenities for life skills, you know, day-to-day living, cooking food, this and that. But man, it's been really nice being away from scooters and motorcycles and cars and everything, and some of that high tech buildings and infrastructure, you know, skyscrapers. I haven't seen that in quite a while. So it's a double-edged sword. It's really nice to see these people here. This is what they're used to. This has been their environment. Oh, and there's a new paved road. We have a paved road that goes all the way through the center, and that's a big deal. And I actually quite enjoy walking that paved road because you can see how much is going on and how that has enhanced the island and the ease for the workers. So it's just a little bit of a time. But I mean, it's 2024 and I feel like I'm in like 1901 kind of, you know, so it's interesting.
I'm reminded of a book by the great social commenter Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And he speaks basically about the double-edged sword that Chris mentions, that we may enjoy the pleasure that comes from watching TV or being able to pull up anything we want at any particular time, but we don't often think of what we're losing when we're enjoying that aspect of things. And in his book, he speaks about the Luddites. And in technology, the Luddites are people that were destroying the printing presses because they didn't want these things to come. And his point is the Luddites had a point. They knew that the printing press was going to change everything. And so their desire to destroy things was really kind of a conservative, let's keep things as they are in some ways before we just go, you know, full force into the new thing that is going to just literally change everything and upend the bits of happiness that we've learned how to have in some ways. So there's a balance between the two, but that book is one that I think a lot about.
I was speaking on that note. I was speaking recently with Peter Malouk, who wrote a few years ago the book Masters of Money with Tony Robbins, and he runs one of the biggest financial planning firms in the United States. He had a few graphs in his latest project that showed that it takes us less hours a week, fewer hours a week, I guess would be appropriate, fewer hours a week to meet our basic necessities, which means, Joseph, to your point, there's more time then for happiness. We have more time then to choose. But the bad news is I feel like what most of us do with that time is we then go on autopilot. That's when the technology takes over. Like if we're not mindful about what we do with the hours of our day, Mark Zuckerberg is very happy to tell us what to do with that time. Elon Musk is very happy to tell us what to do with that time. They will take this time and spend it mindlessly, helping them make more money. And there's a wonderful woman named Catherine Price who has a newish TED Talk, and not a TEDx talk, but a true TED Talk that a lot of people watch about the power of fun and about choosing fun. But you have to go out and find your fun. Much like going out and finding your purpose, you have to turn the device off. In fact, another work that she has is about how to divorce yourself from your phone. And it's like a, you know, like a 12-step program. It's so difficult. But I think as it is easier and easier every year with gains in productivity, it's easier then to waste all this extra time we're given that the people that Chris is on the island with who are still using a horse and buggy spend all their time doing this stuff. We have to decide what to do with that time.
This is a Community Thursday. We are talking to expert Joe Salcihi and community members Christina Golic and Joseph Skillen. And we are discussing the article from Business Insider titled The Upside of Recessions. We're going to take a short break. I'm Doc G, and this is the Earn and Invest podcast.
You know what? I love our meals from Factor. My son started getting them about a year ago when he needed a quick alternative to meals on the go. But where we've really enjoyed them is we've been remodeling our kitchen. That's right, we've had no access to our kitchen for the last few weeks. And some nights, we just had no idea what to do for a meal. That is where Factor came in. We would just pop the meal in the microwave and 2 minutes later, we'd have a fantastic meal. You can do the exact same thing, and there's tons of variety. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week. These are chef-prepared meals, and let me tell you, they are delicious. No fuss, no mess. You just put it in the microwave, and 2 minutes later, you have a meal. This is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Head to factormeals.com/earn50 and use your code EARN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code EARN50 at factormeals.com/earn50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and shows you hidden allies so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/earn. That is linkedin.com/EARN for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/earn and get started.
This is a Community Thursday, and we are back discussing our article from Business Insider by Aki Ito, The Upside of Recessions. Joseph, we've been talking about this data from this article that recessions lead to actually longevity. We haven't really discussed the why. So the why appears to be, at least from this article, and I've seen this in other places before, that during recessions, we tend to have less pollution, less people driving their cars. It tends to be a safer time, especially for the elderly. Tell me what you think about that argument. Does that kind of hit you as true as you take a look at this article?
I think it does. I was a little surprised when I read that in the article, but it reminded me of my experience of moving to my new job after retiring to a new community. But we moved in the middle of the pandemic. We literally moved in April 2020. And we moved to a large city, Charlotte, much larger than where we were previously, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And we saw the city, but it was asleep. And we were kind of looking at what might be possible. And I've had the opportunity now to be living in a community and watch it awaken after the pandemic. And one of the first things that people comment on is, oh my gosh, the traffic. And that's the thing that we didn't experience for the first year and a half. And we were thinking like, oh, this idyllic place where we can go to the parks and it's easy and we can get around to these restaurants and these brew pubs and all these fun things. We were doing it safely, of course, but we were sort of exploring. And then as the city woke up and people went back to the office, the traffic became extremely real and quality of life was far better when the city was sleeping, frankly, and there was more space. And so it really resonated with me. And that kind of reminded me of that actual experience.
Christina, do you remember like the pictures of New York City during the pandemic? Like, and they showed the skyline and all of a sudden you could see for the first time in years. I remember seeing this and thinking, wow, that's a marked difference.
No, I was in Belize, Central America, and I didn't get a lot of U.S. news there. But I do understand the impact of pollution. And I did find that the most fascinating part of the article saying that how much it reduced during that time. I think I'm quite lucky person, because I believe the article was saying, you know, between 2007, 2009 was, you know, the recession they were chatting about and how the pollution had decreased so much. Well, thinking back on where I was at that time, I was back in school again. I was earning my PhD. I had 3 part-time adjunct professor positions at 3 other universities while seeking my PhD at another one. And so I'm hustling my tail off and not seeing the recession, but I know my friends and family were having issues. And then again, during the pandemic, my business exploded. At the time, I had my own online business. I worked with textbook publishers and ed tech companies, and every single school went online during the pandemic. So we edit mathematics materials. So my business exploded. I had to hire more contractors. So I am just lucky, I guess, that I kind of skipped these 2 recessions in my adulthood by happenstance.
I'm almost thinking that the recession and the pandemic were similar in that way, that people hunkered down, and you could use the excuse of, I don't have money in a recession, or you could use the excuse of, nobody's doing anything. And so then it allowed people to explore different ways to find happiness, and we weren't on the roads creating this pollution. And so there was a socially acceptable reason to not do things.
We also, you know, the pandemic, such a horrible time. It affected our family. My brother passed away as a result of COVID. But I also remember on the other side of that, for me, luckily being healthy, I was outside more. Like, I was out walking more. I remember neighbors. We would stay away from each other, but we would pass each other on the street. And I remember seeing these people who live 2 doors down from me, who I had never seen before. For 2 years I'd lived there. 2 years, never saw them. Saw them nearly every day then, and became friends with these people. So for all the horrible stuff that happened, and truly, you know, horrible, I just remember in a maybe a perverse way, some very fond times during that time.
Joe, the article goes a step further, right? It says that noting these type of things like the longevity and the recession, et cetera, there's been a movement that's called the degrowth movement, where people ask, what's the point of having all this money if it's making us worse off? I mean, we just a little while ago talked about this idea, does money make us happier? But the degrowthers are actually saying that maybe money or this wealth or even commerce is bad for us.
Well, they you know, and then they point at the Japanese economy, which has stagnated for 30 years as a very stable place, as a place where happiness levels for people living there seem to be fairly high. Man, I don't know. This is another question that when I got to this part of the piece is above my pay grade again. I don't know that I'm capable of having these big change the universe thoughts. What I kept coming
Joe,
back
Joe, let me interrupt you here. I've known Joe for years, and the minute he says this is above my pay grade, he usually comes up with like the most fantastic point. So he totally does. He's like, I think this is above my pay grade. And then he like puts down like a PhD level discussion of it. So please enlighten us about how this is above your pay grade.
Well, now the pressure's on. So this
totally
this
is. Totally
your
is.
Results are going to vary on what Doc just said. But I do think that as I was reading that, the thought that I kept having over and over is, I think, you know, I keep going back to this idea of choice. We have to decide if we're going to be the building block of this or not. And also knowing the ramifications of being the building block of building society or maintaining, even if you're in a place like Japan, people maintain society. Or am I going to step off the other side of that? I mean, I look back at the Industrial Revolution and all the advances that happened during that time. And there were 2 completely different groups of people. There were people who were dying in factories, building the world. And there were these lords and ladies out in the countryside enjoying the fruits of these other people's labor. Now, that was more of a caste system than we have today. But I think with things like the fire movement, we can at an early age say, you know what, I'm going to play this game for as long as it takes, but then I'm going to enjoy the fruits of somebody else eating the pollution and not me.
Christine, it's interesting because the person who wrote this article at the end talks about how she came to the US from Japan. Japan is the model for the degrowth movement, right? So it had a very, very slow economy over decades and decades, and yet we see lots of positive effects. Yet she says she came to the US and she felt a renewed sense of hope and agency that she hadn't had before. Did that surprise you? Because I was reading that and I was like, this is someone who was supposedly in that better place. And we know longevity in Japan is you know, people live much to a much older age than the US. How did that hit you?
I was thinking, because I believe she said she moved to San Francisco, and I was thinking shiny new toy syndrome. You know, it's a totally new environment. And we do have that workaholic, I don't know, ingrained in us, it seems like, you know, too, that we work to the grind. This is what we do. This is the American way. And I think that it's such a culture shock change. The work side of the American culture is so different from many countries. I've lived in a little over 20 countries now. I've been to 40, 42. And it, oh gosh, it's just vastly different. I cannot compare anywhere to the US when it comes to our work culture. So that was surprising to a bit, but then it wasn't. If you're surrounded by a whole bunch of people that are really hustling, then you kind of want to jump on the train too. And that goes back to how you were talking about comparison earlier. I think that's just kind of how our brains work, right? You know, we learn things by putting it into categories and comparing from one to another. So yeah, I really thought it was the shiny new toy syndrome. She's in a new location. So that renewed sense of activity and strive was just kind of inevitable.
And I think about my family situation. My wife is from Sweden. So we have a socialistic sort of part of our family that thinks about this. And I compare American culture to places that we're told are some of the happiest places on earth. And what's interesting is that Sweden is extremely materialistic, but it's also very egalitarian. And I come back to Joe's comment that I think really choice is the piece of this that kind of makes the special sauce, that not necessarily decelerating an economy, but having an option for a person choosing to live a slower lifestyle and being okay, like one might be in a socialist situation, but then also having an economy that one could jump on and hustle should they choose to do that. And I notice in Sweden, some of the materialistic things, they may not have the income because salaries are relatively equal across society, across job sectors. And so the envy is big. And so that's kind of what drives people to achieve. But then envy is really quite strong in those places, unless someone just chooses to jump off that. And then they're probably going to leave the country. So it's just a interesting sort of way of thinking about that. But choice is a big component, I think.
Well, and I want to back down a little bit from my comment, Joseph, just slightly, because I do know. I mean, as I heard myself and replayed that in my mind, I sound like Gordon Gekko from Wall Street. If people know that, right? I want to say before people think, oh, nice of you, privileged position to say you get to choose. I understand that. But I will tell you this. When I didn't feel like I could choose, what drove me every day to do 1% more to get out of the huge, huge gutter that I was in was this idea that I didn't want to play this game anymore. I was not going to let my whole life be this. And sure, there are circumstances where people don't even get to make that choice. But if in any way you can, I think you want to decide, am I building this or is somebody else going to build it? And I'm going to enjoy it.
So Joe, let's move kind of from where we're talking about right now, which is this idea of personal growth, more to a global look at things. Aki Ito, the writer of this article, suggests that maybe instead of looking at slower growth, we have to think about better growth. And as I think about growing better, especially here in the United States, I think about things like climate change, et cetera. And I wonder if we as a society, especially here in the US, do we really have the appetite for better growth, which might not be as profitable and might be more difficult or take longer?
Another hard question. And I'm not sure that I can answer it. And as a guy who likes to, you know, deal with what can I do personally? I mean, that is a much more global question. But here's what I think is that if I do think about me and I think about my well-being, not in a greedy way, but in a what can I handle kind of way, what can I actually impact? What is, to use a Stephen Covey term, that pot one stuff versus things I can only influence or things that I cannot influence. So as an example, pot two stuff, I could go out and vote for cleaner energy standards. I could go out and I can be a part of the political system. I could be an activist, right? I can also, I think much more pot one, I can realize that you and I have been working together for a long time. Can I swear here? Because there's a very appropriate word here.
Yeah.
Do I want to live in a shithole? Being a guy that just loves beauty and being around beautiful things, I think I have to vote that for me, beauty for me is cleaner energy. You know, beauty for me is things that, you know, I know the people here in Texarkana that run the recycling area. And we have two cities here. One city does a great job of it. And the other city, I found out a few weeks ago, pretends like everybody puts the recycling stuff in the recycling bin and it all goes to the same place. It just makes us feel better that we're separating these things into two different bins. And if you look at recycling, it is so expensive and it's so difficult to do. And there's tons of problems with it. But I think that if we vote with this is what I really want for myself, and I want to live in a beautiful place and I want to be surrounded by beauty, and it makes me happier to wake up every morning in a place that's not polluted, and it will increase my happiness, then I think I can choose things that may be a little bit more difficult on the spectrum, but are ultimately better.
Joseph and Christina, close this out for us. I'm just wondering, after reading this article, do you feel good or bad? Do you feel optimistic or pessimistic? Joseph, you first.
I feel optimistic reading the article, mainly because the author has taken the time to present another way that's possible. And it seems that our society wants to be on the binary. I'm either for this or I'm against this. And as I was thinking about what Joe was describing, you know, one person's better is another person's enemy to a job killer. I think the way of finding that middle ground, that better way, and then just better is sort of that non-dualistic way of approaching a life that could be better for everyone, but doing it in a way that's going to be not threatening to, say, the Luddites that I mentioned earlier. They did have a point. They didn't want to lose their way of life. I'm optimistic that the conversation is going in a non-dual kind of direction and in a place where we might be able to bring people together, but being mindful of those that might see this conversation as a threat just causes me to bring awareness to this conversation.
Christina, after reading this, optimistic or pessimistic?
I think I'm kind of right in the middle. You know, I can see that we have made great strides to try and reduce pollutions in different ways. You know, I think about emission testing that we have with vehicles in the US, which does not exist in other countries that I have been to, and other things along the lines like recycling and whatnot. But on the flip side of it, I do feel like from the financial standpoint, you know, we still need to earn to be able to support ourselves. There is often a drive for many people to continue to earn more. We say that one more year syndrome, you know, with that. So I'm kind of right in between with it. I think technology will always continue across the world. That's not going to slow down at all, in my opinion.
That's a great point, Chris, about the relative stuff too, because when you and I met in Indonesia, I was surprised by some of the pollution, like just how much pollution there was. Holy cow.
I'm reminded of another book that I really enjoy that's kind of changed my thought about this and the way Chris is describing what it's like in other countries. I too have been in about 40 different countries and lived in many. And the Hans Rosling book, Factfulness, is a real positive take on the fact that it talks about the trajectory of positive improvement across our planet. Chris's comment was talking about developing nation versus non-developing nation. And Rosling speaks about the fact that he really would rather we think about not the binary, but think about everything's on a trajectory, and that trajectory mm-hmm. is positive. And one of his statistics I just love is the fact that, you know, over a span of 50 years, more guitars were sold across the country. So more people were finding free time to pursue interesting things and make beauty in the world rather than the dearth of them that were happening 50 years before. So he just really takes some interesting points about the way we can look at the overall trajectory of human development is actually more positive than we might imagine.
That's a good point, Joseph. I just remember, you know, looking at the Indian economy just at the year 1990 versus today, just a whole different economy in India. For one, as one example, that completely a spectrum and on a moving target.
Well, Joe, Joseph, and Christina, I wanted to thank you for being on the show today. I really liked this article because I think sometimes we decide something is good for us because it sounds good or we've been told it's good. But the truth of the matter is, sometimes we have to look a little bit further. A growing economy is excellent, except when it isn't, and people are dying when they maybe don't need to be. We often talk about the stock market, and often the stock market has its best growth when the economy is in recession. So they're just things that I think we need to look at and realize that it isn't always as it appears and that we could question further as this study does. I want to end this episode the way into every episode. Joe Salcihi is our expert today. Joe, tell us what is happening with the Stacking Benjamins podcast and how people can get in touch with you if they want to learn more.
I feel very weird you calling me the expert when these big global issues are not my expertise. Handling my wallet, my financial plan might be more in my wheelhouse. But every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, the Stacking Benjamin show, you'll hear Doc G on it fairly often. You've heard Chris on it. Joseph, we haven't had you on yet, but it's only a matter of time, big guy, till we snare that big interview. So come listen to us and hang out with us.
Christina Gowlick, Joe Salcihi, and Joseph Skillen, thank you so much for being on Earn and Invest today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's a wrap.
Earn and Invest is now part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to this show as well as other fine podcasts.
Okay, you actually won't believe this, but I am in Mexico right now recording from the pool right by the beach. You might be able to hear the waves above me. I wanted to talk about a Substack post I did. That's jordangrummet.substack.com. I've been writing there about purpose, and I did a post called Dying with Lots of Money Will Not Serve You, and it was actually a video I did when I did an interview with Brandon Turner, and I got an interesting response. This comes from Frank Vasquez of Risk Parity Radio. You guys know him well. He looked at this post, and again, when we're talking about dying with lots of money will not serve you, he responds, which leads to the next question, what are good best practices or rules of thumb to avoid dying with excessive amounts of money while presumably not running out of money? Paradoxically, although a lot of lip service is paid to not dying with the most money these days, the stark reality is that the revealed preference or most likely outcome of the personal financial behaviors of most popular personal finance personalities is in fact to die at their highest net worth. So are popular personal finance personalities who espouse not dying with lots of excess wealth largely a bunch of hypocrites? You know, I really like this response, and it made it clear to me that maybe I'm not expressing myself in as clear a manner as I should be doing. You see, I think we've all been influenced by Bill Perkins' Die with Zero. So this idea is money's really important. We should accumulate lots and lots of money, and then we should spend it to make ourselves happy. But I come to it from a completely different angle. You see, I don't think money is that important. In fact, I think what's important is that it supports us so we can live the lives we want to live. So when I talk about if you're dying with lots of money, you're probably doing things wrong, it's not that I care about how much money you have. The idea is actually I don't care about decumulation nearly as much as I care about accumulation. What I find is you have a lot of people who have more than enough money or double the amount of money they need, and yet they're mindlessly still accumulating at jobs they probably don't care about or don't like, and they're wasting the one precious thing they have, which is time. So I almost call this like an accumulation treadmill. If you are spending your time making more money just to make more money, but the activities you're involved in aren't filling you up, and you have over 25 times your yearly spend, you have what we'd call financial independence, then you're basically wasting your time if you continue to work. Now, if you're passionate about work, if you love the work you do,
then by all means do it. My goal is not that you die with zero. In fact, I think most of us hopefully are going to die with millions, maybe even more. The point is you stop trying to accumulate when you have enough money to win the game, and then you go out and enjoy yourself. Now, that's exactly what I'm doing. I don't try to accumulate anymore. I still do accumulate money, and I still love doing certain things that make me money, so there's no way I'm going to die with zero, and in fact, I might die with a lot of money. Does that make me a hypocrite? No, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't really care about money enough to try to die with zero. My goal is to stop doing things to accumulate money where accumulating money is the main goal. And I think that's really the message of the Substack post, as well as what I'm trying to tell everybody, is this idea that we're mindlessly accumulating. We've gotten on that accumulation treadmill and we don't know how to get off. And so that's what my next book, The Purpose Code, talks about. That is what I'm spending a huge amount of time talking to people about in my coaching program, Path to Purpose Coaching. That's at earninvest.com/coaching. I talk to lots and lots of people, and most of them are on the accumulation treadmill. They are accumulating and accumulating. They don't love their jobs. They feel something is missing. They have way more than enough money to leave their jobs now and retire. The problem is it's really hard to step off the accumulation treadmill. We have it hammered into our minds that we must keep accumulating, even when it no longer serves us. And so that's what I was trying to get at the Substack post. That's what I'm trying to get at when I do coaching with my coaching clients. We have to learn how to step off that accumulation treadmill. Once you've won the game, spending your time doing things you don't like to make more money, even if it's tons and tons of money, is a waste of our most precious resource. It's a waste of time.
All right, I leave things running just for a few minutes to catch the after show. I love that, man. Every time we do, Joe, these community episodes, I'm like, yes, this is exactly what I want, because you guys are so smart. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but like the conversations you have, it's funny because, again, we try to get, you know, experts or personalities and we have these conversations. But it's kind of your guys' input that I think really rounds out the conversation in such a pleasing way. And I think takes us in directions we A, normally wouldn't go, and B, just, I think, makes some fuller conversations. So thank you guys for doing this.
Well, the stories of the horse and buggy and the story, Chris's story, and Joseph of More Guitar Sold, like, those are just things that blow my mind. Just fantastic.
That book, Factfulness, if you haven't had a chance to read that, I just couldn't recommend it more. In terms of it talking about the trajectory of growth and what that's done. And Hans Rosling was a Swedish statistician that worked with the World Health Organization. And his job was to really present at Davos and other places to talk to people about what the trajectory looks like of human development and put it in a way that everybody gets it. And one thing I like about that book the most is he asks these questions that we think we would just be easily, they could be easily answered. But he has like monkeys just randomly selecting answers versus world experts versus people he randomly asks on the streets, and the monkeys win hand down every single time,
of course,
to these things. And so there's like a little monkey graph that goes through the book, and it's just you would think it'd be a dry book, but it's very, very positive, and is actually quite humorous at times. And I'm reminded of like Morgan Housel spoke about, you know, recently in a podcast I recently heard, this talk about this time he spends reading and exploring, just kind of, that's such positive time and time well spent to just think about contextualizing your world, and you just do it by looking into other people's worlds and having the time to read. So I valued what he said about that.
I'm just finishing this Power of Fun book with Catherine Price, which I also love. But
yeah, you've brought that up a few times, yeah.
Yeah, it hit me hard. But, well, you know why it hit me hard? It hit me hard because it totally agrees with the way I look at life. And anybody that agrees
like,
with my
You're like, I'm right. I'm right. I knew it.
It is justification. I'm like, see, gamification and making stuff fun is the number one way to learn. It is the number one way to learn. But,
well,
but But it's super. But anyway, I'm just finishing it. So Joe, I'm gonna look up that audiobook.
Joe, I was gonna let you know that I just downloaded your book on Audible, and I've been listening to it. And I know you've been pitching your $1.99 version on Amazon or Kindle or whatnot. Well, I really love the audio version. I would actually like to see a text version because of how you put that together with other interviews. Was a great creative way that I don't know what that looks like on paper, but I'm really enjoying it. I'm still at the end of part one, so I have a ways to go, but it's great.
It starts off really basic, and the nerdy stuff is at the back. But thank you. When Paula Pant joined me on the book tour, she was signing what she called was the best page 13, which is her page. And she's like, this is the best part of the book. You don't have to read anymore.
You don't have to read the rest. Don't read past page 13. Great. Just what you want someone saying about your book.
It feels really good to be productive, but a lot of the time it's easier said than done, especially when you need to make time to learn about productivity so you can actually, you know, be productive. But you can start your morning off right and be ready to get stuff done in just a few minutes with the Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day podcast. New episodes drop every weekday, so listen and subscribe to Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts. That's Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts.
You care about your money. Of course you do. So, why aren't you listening to SoFi Daily? This podcast will keep you updated on the latest news in the stock market and how it could impact your financial life. Stay on top of what's happening. Listen to SoFi Daily, wherever you get your podcasts. That's SoFi Daily, wherever you get your podcasts.